All right, we're here in Accra, and we've got some folks across the country in, I think, Portland and San Francisco to talk to. Oh, there they are now. I think Eric Klein and Jennifer Waits from the Radio Survivor website and now radio show are here with us. Are you guys there?
Greetings, yes.
Hi, Tom.
Hello. We've got America turned down, but we still have the Quintron's Weather Warlock behind you, and there's a mic outside at Wave Farm picking up the sound, and I hear we might hear some sewing, too. Is that correct?
My partner is going to keep working because Wave Farm is a special radio station. It's the kind of radio station where you can keep sewing in the same room as an interview taking place.
Yeah, there might be some listeners sewing, too.
I wish I had as equally interesting ambient sounds behind me in San Francisco, but it's fairly quiet at the moment.
Open the window.
Yeah, you can open. Well, is it cold there? What is it like in Portland and San Francisco?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's sunny, probably in the 70s.
That doesn't describe Portland today. Portland is a rainy 51 degrees. It is also beautiful, though.
Let's see what the temperature is, but it is, I've got the National Weather Service site is not on here. It's cold around, it's 35 degrees, and we're expecting 2 to 4 inches of snow tonight.
Oh, Lord. Here. I'll take Portland.
So that's what the weather sounds like if you can hear the weather warlock behind you. I don't know if you guys can hear that or just hear my voice.
Yeah, sadly, I cannot hear the weather warlock, but I'm going to tune into that channel later, though.
All right, well, we should get to it and tell you guys, why don't you tell our listeners what Radio Survivor is?
Well, we are a website and a radio show that delves into various aspects of radio culture. So we started the website in 2009 to write about radio from the perspective of practitioners and fans rather than the industry. And then the podcast started in June 2015, and it's a weekly podcast now on about 15 radio stations across the country, too, which is pretty exciting. And I have a particular penchant for college radio and community radio, and then my colleagues dig into other aspects of radio as well. So we like to highlight interesting radio stories.
Yeah, we have a radio historian, we have a radio nerd. That's what Radio Survivor does.
Yes, and it airs currently at its scheduled time is 6 a.m. on WGXC on Saturdays. But today and other days it airs at 8 a.m. when the Off the Hook show from WBAI, the hacker radio show, is WBAI is internally in pledge drive mode because they have one problem after another. Currently their antenna rental on top used to be on top of the Empire State Building. I don't know, maybe it still is or it's a different building now, but they've got all kinds of problems and they're always having either off the air or extended pledge drives. And so the Radio Survivor show slides into the 8 a.m. hour. And I guess we'll announce it here first. We haven't told all the 2 p.m.s yet, so I hope they're not listening. But we're going to put Radio Survivor on at 2 p.m. on Saturdays starting in, I think it's April, when the currently, our 11 a.m. Radio Files series is focusing on each of the different stations in the Radia worldwide network of radio art stations. And when they've featured each and every station, then we'll have that time slot open to Ooh. Move our 2 p.m. into the 11 a.m., and then you guys will move into the 2 p.m. Eastern time Ooh. Slot.
I just learned about that. I just learned about that Radia project that you just described, Tom, but I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet.
Oh, well, you should check it out. Radia is since, 2004, 2002. I'm not sure when, but there's 25 or so stations across the world that each make a radio art show every week for the others, and then they air it. All the other stations air it, and then they all take turns. We all take turns making shows. And we had a big conference in Germany last was it last year? Well, I guess it's 2 Octobers ago, October 2016, in Halle, Germany, at Radio Korax, where we all convened. As many stations as possible could make it, and that was quite fun. They had a month-long radio art festival there, and there's a book coming out soon, and all kinds of archives online. So
that's a great pitch for a Radio Survivor episode in the future, because we focus on the United States because we live here, but we love world community radio and in all its forms.
And we've been trying to actually, like, over the years, I've been wanting to do more about radio art on Radio Survivor. So it's a good reminder to keep that in our future episodes idea generator.
All right. And I know of you guys first from Paul Rimsmondale. Back in the our station grew out of the pirate radio or microcasting movement in the 90s, and he was sort of involved in that, I guess. And how did Radio Survivor get started? I guess is where I'm going.
Yeah, well, so in maybe before 2009, we launched in 2009 as a website, and it was an idea that Matthew Lazar had, was to have a website called Radio Survivor. And he reached out to Paul Rimsmondale,
Matthew did a website too before that, didn't he?
Matthew was blogging about the FCC, and so I believe his website was called Lazar's Letter.
Right. Yes. That's what it is.
And then he realized that he wanted to not be just a solo act in the blog sphere, so he joined forces with Paul.
Yeah, and Paul was doing the Media Geek website and radio show, and then they
proto
reached out
podcast.
He was in Champaign-Urbana then, or earlier, or Madison. Where was he then?
When he started Media Geek, I'm not entirely sure, but he was definitely in Champaign-Urbana. When we started Radio Survivor, he was in Chicago. But I don't know the whole trajectory of the Media Geek show. And then Paul reached out to me. This was all very early on, to see if I would like to join up. And so the three of us...
Because you were blogging about college radio in a very passionate and solo endeavor.
Yeah, I started writing about college radio on my blog, Spinning Indie, in 2008. And had actually visited the radio station that Paul was the advisor for at Northwestern, WNUR. But did not meet Paul. So I think maybe through that, Paul kind of... got connected with me, and so the three of us launched Radio Survivor in 2009, figuring that we would all working together, we were all providing these we were all writing about different aspects of radio, so bringing it all together into one website seemed to make a lot of sense. So
jump forward many years later, Paul and I met in Portland, Oregon. Because we were bound to meet. We had so many mutual interests and mutual friends that it's funny that it took so long. And as soon as we got together over coffee, we realized that we wanted to make a podcast together for Radio Survivor. I hadn't been writing on Radio Survivor. Actually, I think I had one guest spot as a writer about a Portland story after I'd left the Bay Area. So Paul and I started the radio show and podcast. What was it now? 129 episodes ago, covering the world of community radio, college radio, non-commercial, low-power FM radio, pirate radio, and podcasting when it serves communities. That's how we like to talk about what the show's about.
And
pretty all-encompassing.
What was your background in Eric? Or were you writing or?
I wore all of the hats that they would let me wear, and then I stole some hats over at KPFA, the Berkeley affiliate of the Pacifica Radio Station, the very first listener-sponsored radio show radio station in the country, founded by pacifists in 1949, and I worked at Free Speech Radio News when I was at KPFA. I worked in the news department at KPFA. I did so many fun things as a volunteer while I was there. So that's and then having left that world and moving to Portland, where there are some very wonderful radio stations, but I just had an itch to launch this show.
And then, Jennifer, I think I cut you off. You were about to sum up what Radio Survivor does, I think, maybe?
Oh, I was just going to add to it, but maybe I'll describe my background a little bit.
Sure.
Too. So I've been doing college radio since I was in college, pretty much.
Where was that?
At Haverford College near Philadelphia. On a
Jennifer's the world's preeminent expert on the history of Haverford radio at her alma mater.
That very well could be Haverford. I've become like, so I started in college radio in college, and I've been at four different stations, four different college radio stations total, and I've also become
doing music.
Doing music shows, and I've also become a college radio historian. And it started really because of my fascination with the history of Haverford Station. And they had students started a radio station there in 1923.
Oh, my goodness. So it is a historic station.
Yeah. Well, I mean, radio, that station doesn't exist anymore. The station that started in 1923 only lasted for 4 years. But
that was one of the first college radio stations ever?
You're going to trigger Jennifer.
I know, don't trigger me.
That language. This is something we talk about on Raid Survivor all the time, and I really enjoy it when Jennifer corrects the record. It's very difficult to find the first, the oldest, and that's one of the reasons why what Jennifer does is so cool, is that college radio history is not as well documented as it should be because it's so cool. Who knows who the first radio station is?
And you should always question first claims. And this is probably my high school journalism teacher, like, in my ear, you know, to always question anytime somebody makes a bold statement.
Jennifer, what's the first all-woman college radio station in America?
Oh, I don't remember. And that's also probably up for debate. The Haverford station in 1923 may very well, it was probably one of the earliest student-run radio stations during that 1920s time period, because, you know, think about it, that was the very early days of radio. So a lot of the 1920s stations on college campuses were really coming out of physics departments and professors.
And radio clubs, weren't there like radio clubs around the country then?
Yeah, so this was a radio club at Haverford, and you know, there was even a freshman who was one of the masterminds behind the station. So they were really, I think it's a really important station to look at, and that history is not well known. And at one point, they could be heard 1,000 miles in every direction. You know, they had this powerful transmitter. It's before you had turntables powered by electricity. So most of what they played as far as music, it was mostly live music. So they would play concerts.
Were there even mixers or boards then? It was just all microphones? I haven't even thought about that.
I know, yeah, and I'm not, they would rig up things, they would piece together pieces of other equipment in order to build some of the apparatus that they used at the station. And they probably aired a lot of lectures. So it's a pretty interesting station, and they had a very active amateur radio club. And did things like an international chess match by radio with Oxford University.
Wow.
That got written up in the New York Times. So, some pretty weird...
In the 1920s.
Crafty stuff. That happened in the 1920s. So that really sparked my interest in college radio history.
Jennifer, can you explain to us, to me as well as the listeners of Wavefarm, like... how you found this stuff out? Like, what kind of box did you have to dig in to learn these secrets of your college radio station alma mater?
Well, I mean, luckily, there were people over the years who really had the foresight to save materials at Haverford. So in special collections, they have boxes of materials related to radio. And so there have been articles written over the years documenting that history. And even though that was the case, when I was in college radio there in the 80s, I was unaware of this history, even though it had been written about previously. And what I've been able to contribute to it is I did additional alumni I did additional interviews with alums, so I have some of the personal stories.
Right. You filled in a lot of the blanks from the 1960s, I'm assuming?
Yeah, probably since about 1960. You know, there were some great articles written, I think, in 1960 or 1970. There was a great historical piece written by a student. So I'm lucky because a lot of materials were already there. And I also combed through newspaper articles. Student newspapers and student yearbooks are great sources of information about college radio history.
And Jennifer, you were at Haverford, so that's why Haverford was exciting to you. But it's not wrong to assume that this kind of exciting hidden history of college radio is everywhere.
Oh, yeah. And not just college radio. You know, there's a high school radio station in Portland that started in 1923 also, which is, you know, another...
Which is still on the air.
Yeah, another source of fascination. So that could be the oldest, you know, still operating high school radio station. So in part because of all of this, I got involved with the Radio Preservation Task Force, which is a project of the Library of Congress. And I wanted to make sure that there was a college radio voice on this project. So I've been working with a lot of other people, you know, trying to figure out where historic collections exist related to college radio and also high school radio, educational radio, and community radio. So that's been a fun project, and I try to bring some of that to Radio Survivor and write about history whenever I can as well.
And I guess what's going on in college radio, I mean, all I hear about in college radio is negative, it seems like, these days. Colleges selling off their stations or, the college down the street or in radio distance, I guess, is Bard College, and they applied for the full power educational license when we got ours, and then they didn't bother to go through with it. Like, is that the problem these days? Colleges are all giving up on FM terrestrial radio?
Oh, Tom, why are you doing this to us?
Not necessarily. I think, unfortunately, the articles that we see or the press that we see in mainstream press tends to be about negative college radio stories.
Yeah, this is certainly an ongoing conversation that we have on the Radio Survivor show.
And radio in general, too, the press is focused on. It's a thing of the past.
As my colleagues will tell you, that it's the number one media source in the United States. Everybody listens to radio still, but it just
and that's
is
why,
not
you know,
being loved in the media.
Even people that don't have Facebook accounts.
Exactly.
Jennifer, you're going to answer Tom's question about is college radio dead?
No, it's not dead. And I write a column for Radio Survivor every week about college radio, just sharing the news of the week. And for the most part, the news of the week is not negative. And that's part of why I try to just bring these stories to light. So
the big stations appear to be victims of market forces. The frequencies on which they are broadcasting, these large college radio stations, which have recently been sold out from under the people that make these stations live, they're just worth so much darn money.
So it's like the 1996 Telecommunications Act. When that passed, mom and pop stations were coming to the pirate community saying, how do we become pirates? Because we've got to sell off because of the economics of the situation.
Yeah, so that's not a radio is dying narrative. That's radio is worth the whole – radio is valuable.
Right.
It's just that it's if the college community isn't prepared to stand up to protect what's valuable, there can be like a sneak attack. It's not valuable at all. It's worth nothing. So we're going to sell it for millions of dollars.
Yeah, and there are a few things going on. There's still, I'm still trying to compile my master list of all the college radio stations in the United States, and it's probably over 800. And that encompasses all kinds of categories. You know, online only, terrestrial, low power FM, AM. Part 15, and you know, you still have a lot of very high-powered FM college radio stations operating and doing well, and you also had a flurry of new stations thanks to the Local Community Radio Act. So, you know, a number I would say over 100 colleges or university related groups applied for low power FM licenses in the 2013 window. And so we've seen some new low power FM college radio stations. And we continue to see new streaming only college stations popping up, you know, like every few months. So, you know, young people in college still seem as interested in radio as they always have been.
And we should mention that you guys are currently airing on a full power FM signal, a part 15 signal on the internet on several different web streams, and so WGXC's FM signal. But you also may be airing eventually on WOOCLP, the station in Troy that we partner with that also airs the Radio Survivor show.
It's cool. and we love that. That's, you know, like, we love being on the stations that we're talking about, you know, and covering all those categories. It's amazing.
How is the LPFM rollout going? Are all the stations on the air now? Or are there still some struggling to get on? I've seen some interesting stories this week about the station that went from playing what language? I don't remember, to going to play Outlaw Country, and then the other station that had their tower that had their antenna illegally on a American Tower tower without paying rent because the mayor or someone gave them the access code.
Yeah, I think it went from Slavic programming to country.
Oh, right, Slavic. Yes.
Intriguing. I think most stations. I think most are on the air, but I know of quite a few that aren't quite on the air yet. In San Francisco, there are a few that are getting close. But I'm pretty sure most of the applications have been processed. I'm not sure if there may be a few stragglers that are still being considered.
The one I would assume it's the ones where they're deciding between multiple applications that so they might have to split time or something.
Yeah, I feel like there might be just a handful or less of those.
It's really hard to say because there's no, as I understand it from my work with my colleagues, Paul Rees-Mandel and Jennifer Waits on Radio Survivor, because they tell me things and that's how I learn this stuff. There's no central repository of information about which low power FMs are going on the air or are struggling. You really just have to be a member of the community.
The REC networks isn't I guess that would be the place I would go to look for that information.
Right. Yeah, that's a great resource. And also LPFM database has a website where you can look at all the low power FM stations. And that indicates
And these are community
there.
These are community endeavors, not like official government lists.
Yeah, the REC networks has written code to pull the information from the FCC website because the FCC website is not very easy to use.
Exactly. You have to practically have a degree in figuring out how to navigate that website.
And they're about the only ones, I think, that have that degree.
it's amazing. And particularly during the whole process when licenses were first getting awarded, I was constantly on the REC website monitoring, you know, because they had an updated list of the newly granted construction permits. So it's very helpful.
But, I mean, as far as we know, this low-power FM flourishing across the United States is really – it's just an incredible story that I don't think very many people, like – get a chance to. I mean, I'm a victim of hyperbole. I'm likely to overstate the case, but I mean, because there was a New York Times article written recently about all these low power FM stations going on the air. But for the most part, it's like there's so much more community radio in 2018 than there was, let's just say, 20 years ago. There's so much more voices broadcasting, and it's all it's really hard to wrap your head around how many stations there are now.
And we like to remind people that it was because of thousands of pirate radio stations and microcasters that this really got rolling. And there's I like to tell this story. The people like you guys will like this. We were a part of the microcasters in the late 90s, and the Radio Liberty folks in Philadelphia, that I don't know if you know about that. I mean, they morphed into Prometheus Radio Project, but at the time they were Radio Liberty. You know that church in West Philly? Jennifer probably knows that church in West Philly. They had a conference of all the pirates in the country, on the east half of the country. There was another one on the west coast, maybe in Seattle or Portland, I'm not sure. But the east coast pirates all met in Philadelphia at the basement of that church in West Philly. And the keynote speaker was the head of enforcement at the FCC.
Wow. Huh.
And people had video cameras, and I've searched for years on YouTube, and I've never seen the video uploaded. But I was there, and it was a strange and wonderful moment.
That's really cool, Tom. Tell us more about that, because we've talked about that on Radio Survivor, how it was unlicensed broadcasters, pirate radio stations, going on the air without official permission, that sort of forced to the hand of the FCC, proving that there was a bottled up need. And that they needed to, grant licenses to all of these communities.
Yeah, I believe there was a station in the Bay Area that the commercial station stopped airing the city council meetings, so the pirate station started airing the city council meetings. I like to mention Kind Radio in San Marcos, Texas, as often as I can. They're probably my favorite station of the era. They had a system where if you called in to talk to whoever was DJing a show, when the DJ picked up the phone to answer it, it automatically went on the air and the music squelched down. So no matter when you called, you were on the air. And San Marcos is a town situated between San Antonio and Austin. And so there's stations licensed to that town, but they don't mention anything about San Marcos. They're all focused on advertising to San Antonio and Austin, where there's more dollars. And so there was a giant flood in the era where the whole town was underwater, and the mayor, had to go on the pirate station to get information out to the populace because the commercial stations didn't bother talking about the town that they were broadcasting from.
Wow.
And this is all a result, I'm going to guess, of the 1996 Telecommunications Act.
Well, it started before that with Dunifer and what's his name in Springfield, Illinois, Mambano Kataka, started it. And Dunifer really, Stephen Dunifer in Berkeley, really got the movement going nationally. He was protesting the first Gulf War and didn't think that there was really an outlet even on the non-commercial stations to talk about.
Even KPFA, huh?
I guess, you have to ask him.
I would love to ask Stephen Dunifer.
He became the Johnny Appleseed building thousands of transmitters. And then I'll tell the other story. I came from Tampa, Florida, and where there at one point were seven pirate stations that had a meeting in a church. The Tampa FCC office ended up busting more pirates than any other state office in the country. Right. And that was largely because of Miami, too, and Orlando. But so the stations that they were there was like the cousin of the boxer Hector Macho Camacho had a station. So there was a station in a church. There was 87X was a station I was a part of forming. That was we were in a neighborhood called Ybor City, that one of those places where the interstate ran through in the 60s, and they killed the this old Latin neighborhood. And then artists started coming back in the late 80s and the early 90s, and I had a record store there, and there was a bookstore, and there were other things bring it to life. And then there was this one giant festival that happened every year that was a benefit for a local arts organization, but it ended up kind of ruining the neighborhood because so many people would come and drink in the streets that it became popular. And then so the neighborhood went from having three bars to having 150 bars. And I'm not kidding.
Whoa.
A 15 or 18, I think it's 18-month period. And so we started the station basically. We weren't connected. We didn't know about the whole national movement, but we knew that we were being gentrified, out of our community. And so we wanted to create a virtual place where we could still do shows and have discussions and such. And one of the folks in our midst was a veteran of was he a Vietnam veteran, maybe a post-Vietnam veteran? But he basically took an old Army radio and turned it into a FM transmitter. And he wasn't so good at it. He's much better now, but he wasn't so good at it then. Those rare days when it got cold in Florida, our signal would drift from 87.7 up to 87.9 or something. 'Cause
things would shrink.
Yeah. and he didn't have the what do you have to put some capacitor or something. There's some electronic thing that that you do to save that, but he didn't know all that yet. And but that's how we started. But there was a famous after I moved to New York, but there was a famous day in pirate radio history. I think it's like November 7th, 1997, where 2 weeks prior, this guy Doug Brewer was one of the seven pirates at this meeting. He had a station called the Party Pirate, and his station is notable in pirate radio history because it actually made the Arbitron ratings at one point.
Whoa.
And the newspapers were reporting the last station on the list was this pirate radio station.
Oh my god!
Wait, what city was he in?
This is Tampa, Florida. Okay. And so he was on the cover of the Wall Street Journal 2 weeks before this date I'm about to tell you about, where they put the Wall Street Journal does that little sketch of the people. Yeah. So there's a little sketch of Doug Brewer on the cover of the Wall Street Journal in late October '97. Because he was making transmitters like Dunifer and selling them to all over the country. He sold us our first transmitter. And so on one day in early November, the FCC office came with SWAT teams at 6 in the morning and busted 87X, the station I was involved in starting, the Party Pirate, and this third station, Lutz Community Radio, which was run by this guy, Lonnie Cobras, who was a member of the Tea Party 13 years before he knew it, this kind of far, far right-wing anti-tax nut who I have an interview with who describes the getting arrested by the SWAT teams. And his he ends the quote saying, "They put me in a foreign-made car, a non-police car." So he was more upset that they put him in a Toyota instead of a Ford.
Strange bedfellows.
Yes. So, there's a giant this bust at three stations. There's all these. You can go onto YouTube and find the news clips about it from the era. That was my background. We never got our station was called Free 103.9, which we still use as our Twitter handle. Brooklyn, we started in 1997, so we just had our 20-year anniversary last year. As an organization, we eventually became a nonprofit and stopped doing the illegal broadcasting. But
unlicensed,
yes.
But station is illegal, Tom.
And what was I going to say? That we never got. Oh yeah, we never got. Found by the FCC. As far as we know, there was one or two times we got visits from people. We don't know exactly who they are, but I think they were all other pirates. We did get visited by other pirates. We had a yard sale, a sidewalk sale one day, and we're broadcasting from a sidewalk stoop sale in Brooklyn. And this Hasidic gentleman comes riding on his bike and says he saw our flyers and you guys are having our pirate station. He tells us that he has a pirate station too and that he's getting trouble from the more conservative Hasidic community because he airs mostly just news about Israel and was, telling the also airing news about from the Palestinian point of view and not just the so he was getting trouble from the higher ups. Huh. And the there's a famous case later in Brooklyn that you can find online somewhere too that there's a Jewish courts system in Brooklyn, and maybe it's other places too, but they have their own internal court. And there was a pirate radio station run by this couple, and they went on vacation, and the engineers working for them took all the equipment and moved it to their house or something and started the station from there. And so they, instead of this being dealt out in the normal civil courts, there's a whole case about it in the Jewish courts where I think the original couple won. Yeah, you can. I think that was in. I can't remember the publication, but I haven't looked at it in many years.
Maybe the Jewish Daily Forward, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't think it was that. It was a Brooklyn newspaper. It was definitely a local Brooklyn newspaper, but there was an online version of it at one point, telling that story.
I'm going to start Googling as soon as we're done here, Tom. Well, one of the things that I've been taught by this Radio Survivor Project, by John Anderson, who lives out in Brooklyn, is the
He's on our board of directors.
There you go. By board of directors of Wave Farm, John Anderson, is that there's often a very pent-up need for community radio in immigrant communities in New York City or in Miami, Florida region. And that pent-up need finds an outlet on unlicensed pirate radio stations, and they're serving communities in their languages, non-English language communities, doing community radio, right? just not having permission from the FCC.
Yeah, and some of them have advertising, and I think the reason they have advertising is because the local barbershop doesn't have a place to sell its services to the community. And so you might think that having advertising on a pirate station is wrong or something, but it actually makes a lot of sense that these communities, it explains why they exist, because the local barbershop doesn't have a way to reach customers except through the pirate radio station.
Yeah, it's kind of like the equivalent of underground newspapers, you know, from days of yore. If the mainstream publications aren't doing their job, then other alternatives are going to pop up.
Yeah.
And so you guys cover current pirate radio too?
It comes up. we have a handful of episodes talking about unlicensed broadcasting. I think we're probably due for another one. But yeah, it's definitely a part of the Radio Survivor multiverse.
What do you think comes up more? Jennifer, you go first. Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, there's obviously this micro radio history that that helped create the Low Power FM movement. But there's also a group of people who want to distance themselves from pirate radio in the Low Power FM movement. So, and I know that, you know, if people...
The stigma.
Well, yeah, and some people weren't able to apply for low-power FM construction permits because they participated in pirate radio activity. So I'm curious if at Wave Farm, if you felt any of that, if you felt backlash from people who are against the micro radio movement.
Well, that's funny, you know, that they passed the rule that if you were involved in pirate radio, then you couldn't apply for a low power FM station. We applied for a full power FM station, and there's no such there's no such rule about...
Nice loophole, Wave Farm.
It's just ludicrous. You know, the thing up here, there's only like two mom and pop radio stations left in our area. And I think both of them, the people that behind them, started in pirate radio, you know. And when we were a pirate station 87X in Tampa, when it was in the record store I had, we had this guy come in once and say, and I was at the counter, I remember, and he was a square-looking guy and the kind of guy we would normally be with or without the pirate station. We might be a little wary of, like, why is he in this weird record store that has hip-hop shows and punk rock shows? And he says, "You guys have a pirate radio station here. I can tell." And we're like, "No, we don't have a pirate radio station. What are you talking about?" He's like, "I saw the antenna on the roof. That's a transmitting antenna, not a receiving antenna." And he was an engineer at a local, like 98 Rock commercial radio station. And he had a pirate radio station himself, he's told us. He claimed it.
That's so funny.
So the people that work at radio stations often have pirate radio backgrounds. They were interested in when they were young, and they created their own transmitter, or they got a little transmitter and broadcast out of their house, and that's why they're into it still.
Go ahead, Jen.
Well, and that's, you know, sometimes people describe early college radio stations as being like pirate stations. You know, so these dorm-based carrier current stations, some might describe as pirate, even though, you know, they're technically legal because they're under FCC Part 15 rules. So there's a lot of kind of gray area and sort of intersections between legal low power and pirate and then low power FM. So I definitely agree that somebody who would be interested in creating radio might have participated in a variety of types of radio.
And if you're listening, this is WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. It's our Radio Magic Pledge Drive. And so we encourage you to call 518-697-7400 or go online to wgxc.org/donate. Do you guys have any tips for Pledge Drive getting people to call?
Oh, boy. Well, I will say this. These radio stations, like Wave Farm, are so important. It's like, you know, I've lived in a few cities and I've watched these cities change. And, you know, when I was younger, I used to assume that change was slower, and it's not. It can be really fast and kind of very disruptive and not always for the best. And so one of the things that we all who love community radio stations need to focus on is keeping that going and making sure that, you know, the reason I brought up cities is everywhere I move, I watch local used bookstores go out of business. They blink out like Christmas lights every few years, every bookstore that I like. And it's really important that the same thing doesn't happen to these sorts of radio stations. They have a lot to give now in the present, and they have a lot to give to the future. You know, there are young people now who are just going to be discovering radio for the first time, you know, now. And they should have a place to go to make good radio for their community in the years to come. Yeah. So support your local radio stations.
We have a block of youth programming from Monday through Saturday from 3:30 to 4 p.m. where young people make radio. There's a show about with the local librarian about talking about books they've read. There's a show called Game Hoarders where they talk about new video games that just came out. There's a couple shows where they played one plays very new music and one plays very, very old music. We're working on putting a couple new shows from different community centers for, on around the area for young people, too. So 518-697-7400 is the number to call, or WGXC.
Say the number slower.
I know. I go so fast. 518-697-7400 is the Twin Peaks version of the number. Or you can go online to wgxc.org/donate.
Yeah, I feel like these radio stations that we love are like, they're like seed banks for the best ideas of how radio should be made, while the rest of the radio dial has sort of been allowed to turn into a wasteland. Like, it shouldn't be that way. But so even the good ideas from the commercial radios can sort of can find safe harbor on these radio stations that need listener support to survive.
I talk about Rush Limbaugh's use of silence. Not anymore. He's not any good anymore. But he used to be really good, and silence was his weapon, his best weapon in his arsenal. But I'm sorry, I cut you off again, Jennifer.
Oh, well, I'm just thinking about, you were asking about tips for fundraising, and I have to do fundraisers at the station where I DJ, and we like to talk about, you know, what does this station mean to you, and what does it mean to you as the person hosting the show? What does it mean to you as a listener? And you know, you should support this station. And sometimes I'll ask people, imagine your life without Wave Farm. You know, what would it sound like? And I think, you know, people probably don't realize how unique a station like Wave Farm is, where you have transmission art. You know, we don't have a station like that in the San Francisco Bay Area that is playing so much radio art in addition to all of the community programs that you're talking about. So I think that's really special to have this outlet for these artists who are doing some incredible work.
Yeah, and providing concrete support for those artists, not just access to the airwaves, but also so much more than that.
Yeah, I've never understood the United States has so few radio stations that do any radio art. I mean, Canada has a bunch, and Europe has a bunch, and some other places in the world. But the United States has very few stations that are interested in radio art at all.
Yeah, it's really unusual. And I think you might have smatterings here and there in the late night hours on college radio stations. But it's not as formalized as the stations you're talking about in Canada and in Europe, where, you know, it's really a really strong dedication to the medium, which to me is really exciting. Like, I love running across unusual radio stations and hearing things that are unexpected over the airwaves. So I really applaud you for what you're doing, and I wish we heard more of that across the country.
Yeah, some of us like to go to bed, and we still want to hear radio art.
Oh, and you know, speaking of this, I just visited a high school radio station that came out of a music teacher that started this radio station, and they actually have students going out with recorders and recording ambient sounds, like, of nature, and they and they regularly air that over their radio station.
Ooh,
so
what high school station is that, Jennifer?
Well, so this is the station at, it's VCS Radio. Ralph Martin, we've talked to on Radio Survivor on the radio show before, because they have a low power FM station that also is over HD radio. So VCS Radio has multiple channels, including one that airs all student compositions, including some of these more unusual compositions that are recording, you know, ambient recordings from nature.
Again, you're listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. I guess that gives me a good end to ask, do you guys have early childhood memories of radio, or what got you into listening or being interested in radio?
Well, I remember going to sleep at night listening to things like The Shadow on AM radio. So radio drama, that I found that very alluring, going to sleep listening to these creepy radio stories. And then my dad also fixed up this beautiful old shortwave radio, like a really tall wooden radio. And so we would listen to stations from afar on that radio.
Oh, boy. Childhood memories of radio. I listened to Dr. Demento.
All right.
At night. I don't know if I have to describe who Dr. Demento is. Look him up. And
well, you can get you. His name is fairly self-explanatory.
It was a radio show that I liked.
A slightly demented radio show.
That was one of my favorites as well. My sister and I would do kind of pretend Dr. Demento style shows.
When I was a kid on Sundays, my father would listen to Pacifica affiliate KPFK on a regular basis. And there was a call-in show called The Car Show. And now the adult version of me looking back at that, I'm so impressed that this show was so much better than the click and clack nonsense that that the Tappet Brothers, whatever those guys do. Here was just a community radio show that provided a service to the, you know, and it was on every day in the living room. I really have a connection to their theme song. I remember like one day where they didn't play their theme song and I was flabbergasted. You said, "I lost the record. I can't find it today." I think radio's just always been, it's been on.
And I'll give my story real quick. Is I used to listen to the radio under my pillow to the ends of Baltimore Oriole games. I lived a little north of Baltimore on WFBR. And then the morning DJ, Johnny Walker, is a slightly infamous one of those pre-morning zoo kind of hosts. But he used to do cut-ups of the baseball game into music the way that what's the guy named from the 60s with the UFO things, late 50s, early 60s, I'm spacing on his name now, did. But then I had a little cassette player and started cutting up things in between music too, then, and that led to all this.
Cool.
I just remember when music radio was, like, interesting. I lived in Los Angeles, California, and sometime before the 1990s, you could spin the dial and hear DJs on commercial radio who had opinions about the music they were playing, and that was cool, right?
That was a long time ago.
Was it, though?
As far as commercial radio goes, if you listen to the commercial stations now, they everything is wonderful and great, and you know, but they're not deciding it's some computer in Los Angeles.
There are some interesting commercial stations, you know, more like mom and pop stations that are doing interesting things, especially in rural communities. And I was amazed to hear live news, you know, from a local reporter over one of these rural stations on a Saturday morning up in Mendocino County one time, you know, reporting on fires that were happening. So there are some people doing the good work in commercial radio, and even over some of these stations that might have heavily programmed music programming, Even some of those stations have their moments of doing very, very amazing local news, especially, you know, during times of crisis. So it's hope is not all lost in commercial radio, even though we'd like to kind of categorize all commercial radio stations as being, you know, sort of the same. You know, there are some people doing interesting stuff in commercial radio.
And what are there good stations in Portland and San Francisco now?
Well, Portland is exploding with great community stations for some reason. I think Paul Rees-Mandel has a good analysis on this that I don't want to try to paraphrase. But there are so many new stations on the air now that are non-commercial community radio stations here in Portland, Oregon. I think there was a bottled up need. For some reason, this city that has a very robust art scene just didn't necessarily have the same robust radio scene until this decade. So that's very exciting.
Yeah, and the San Francisco Bay Area has been really lucky as far as the existing non-commercial stations as well, and we have a few low power FMs coming. But we have a whole bunch of college radio stations that are on FM in the San Francisco Bay Area and longstanding community radio stations like KPOO and KPFA. And a lot of kind of recent streaming only radio stations in San Francisco proper. BFF.FM focuses on music and also local public affairs shows, and Mutiny Radio is another online station, and Radio Valencia, folks who used to be a part of KUSF have an online station that is going to become a low power FM station. Ooh. San Francisco Community Radio. So I think it's, I don't know, in the San Francisco Bay Area, we have sort of an embarrassment of riches from high school to college to community radio.
And
if you spin the dial.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Jennifer Waits and Eric Klein from the Radio Survivor website and radio show. And I guess you should give the website address out. And can you what topics come up most on the show and the website?
Ooh, it's so vast. It's radiosurvivor.com is the website where you can find everything, including the radio show. I think. Well, Eric can answer for the podcast.
Yeah.
One thing that I like to do, an ongoing series I have, is visiting radio stations all over the country. So that's something I've brought to both the website and the podcast over the years, are these tales from my radio station tours. And I've been to over 140 radio stations. And it's been fun since adding the radio show, because now I can bring audio from those visits and share audio on our podcast and radio show. So it's more than just the photos and the words from, you know, the blog posts of yore. Now I can bring the sounds of those visits. And I've been, you know, particularly excited about the blossoming and the growth of low power FM. So I've been able to visit brand new stations. And to me, that's been a thrill. Like, when has there been a time in my lifetime when so many new stations have started up? So it's been great to report on the growth of community radio.
Yeah, and I'll talk about our radio show and our podcast, Radio Survivor. You can subscribe on your – I won't plug any podcast platform in particular, but you can subscribe on all of them. And you can also hear Radio Survivor here on Wave Farm. What time are we airing, Tom?
Currently it's at 6 a.m., but it slides into the 8 a.m. Show hour when WBAI is on pledge drive and off the hook of the hacker show is unairable. So like this morning you were at 8 a.m.
And so here on Radio Survivor, we cover the world of non-commercial radio, college radio, community radio, low-power FM radio, and podcasting that serves communities. We have a tag. It's the sound of strong communities, and the show. I'm like scrolling through all of our show topics. We it's, you know, I'm always excited when we talk about the history, because, you know, radio is such a medium of the present. It goes out and then it's there in your ears, and tomorrow it's gone, although these days it's always archived. But knowing about ideas that bubbled up, you know, more than a generation ago in these communities is always exciting. I really like an episode that Jennifer and I did together way back when. I forget what number it is, but it was all about the technology carrier current, which I knew nothing about. And carrier current was extremely popular on college campuses for a generation or two, I guess in the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s mostly. Is that right, Jennifer?
Well, carrier current really starting in the late 30s. And, you know, continuing on to today, there are probably still some stations using carrier current.
So just finding out that there's this way that radio was made.
That's if you're plugged into the electrical outlet, you can hear the station, basically.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, that's one way it works. So, I mean, it's a cable that they could, like, even, like, bury in the ground. And you could use any other piece of long threaded piece of metal in your building. So, yes, the electrical outlet might also be able to carry the radio frequency. I know that some college radio listeners would be able to hear their radio station because of the metal pipes in their building.
Right, yeah, so like the radiator pipes could serve as the antenna.
Yeah, and it was just this a technology that I had never heard of that was used all over the country and the world to bring radio to college campuses.
Yeah, there's
go ahead. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, so
The idea that, you know, just this, like, that I lost my thought. Sorry.
Well, I'll tell my little story. There's a Toronto artist whose name I'm spacing on again now, but he did a project based on, I think it was the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, basically set up a carrier current way to talk around the government forces. With the barbed, they used the barbed wire that the government set up, you know, as war shields or whatever to block parts of the country. But they used the barbed wire as the antenna, in a carrier current system.
Oh wow, that's so rebellious! I love that. Yeah, since Eric was talking about some of our favorite shows, one of my favorites was Eric brought back audio from the antenna raising of a new station in Portland.
And
I kind of felt like I was there because he brought such beautiful audio, and that's a nice part of one of the many nice things about having Eric as part of Radio Survivor now is, you know, to have people who are really skilled in audio production and sound gathering. So it, you know, it being able to share this exciting moment to our listeners, I thought was really cool.
Yeah, that I lived off of the energy of that moment for weeks and weeks and weeks. I was able to, because of Radio Survivor, I was able to take my reporter gear up on the roof in Portland, Oregon, where where a new radio station was putting up their antenna, Freeform Portland. And what was so fun about them getting their act together, getting on the air, was that they were a group of people who all had been inspired by other radio experiences that they'd had in their lives earlier. So a lot of them were coming from a college radio experience at UC Davis, which I know has a really robust college radio culture.
Yeah, KDVS.
Yeah, and so this idea, just the fact that that good radio leads to more people making more good radio, and sharing those ideas, and then things blooming from there. It's always very exciting for me, so I'm glad you remember that episode.
I do.
And the thing I like about Radio Survivor, I think, is that you guys do sort of deep dives into issues. Rather, it's not all the headlines of what happened this week, like the Inspector General investigating Ajit Pai, the FCC chairman, about his relationship with Sinclair Broadcasting or something. But
that's a good one, though.
But the deeper dives about. Like the carrier current station, or was this morning was listener deaf radio.
Yeah, that was so fun. We were able to bring on a podcast producer and fan who was just, spreading the word. It's so weirdly obvious until it's not obvious that deaf people and hard of hearing people love radio and podcasting too. And when you keep that audience, when you know that they're there as a radio producer, there's so many things you can do to include that audience so they're not excluded just because you're making, some weird decision that you hadn't known would exclude the deaf and hard of hearing from enjoying the things you make. So yeah, I was really happy that we got to make that episode.
Yeah, and I think we're doing more of these interview-based episodes that allow for this deep dive into topics like that, which I think is really, really amazing and very educational for me too.
That's what I was going to say. I think you guys must learn something every week.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's great. One of my favorites. I scrolled far enough back. Episode was this? I think this was a episode 103. Was we interviewed a photojournalist who Anita Pouchard-Serra was her name, and she had traveled through Argentina, and through her work in the city had been connected with some media activists who, speaking of unlicensed broadcasting, we learned all about this whole new moment of unlicensed broadcasting in the country of Argentina, where the way she described it, there was a media law that was supposed to be implemented, or was implemented but had no teeth, that would allow for more community radio stations in Argentina. And then because of a change in administration, the promise of this media law was never fulfilled. So communities were going on the air anyway. So here's a wonderful example of, do you call them pirates? Do you call them unlicensed radio? Do you call them rebels? Like, they should have been licensed, but they weren't. And they were taking to the airwaves, to cover the issues for their communities. And that was a real good conversation there on Radio Survivor, episode 103.
Jennifer, you have a favorite episode?
Well, another favorite. I love popular culture, and my master's is actually in popular culture studies. So I love television, and I've always been kind of obsessed with images of radio in popular culture. And so we got to do an interview with some folks behind the team at the TV show The Man in the High Castle.
Oh yeah.
And as part of a promotion for the show, they created this kind of fake pirate radio station, and it's on an app and on a website, and so you can listen to, I think it's four different pirate DJs they have in different parts of the country. The whole theme of the show, it's a Philip K. Dick novel that was turned into a TV show.
Amazon Prime television event.
Yeah, so it's imagining a world where the Nazis and Japan won World War II, and so then
it's not too unlike today.
Right. So what is the United States like?
With white supremacists shooting people in schools and such.
Yeah.
Exactly.
To promote season two of the series, they created this entire in-world, very all-encompassing, very detailed series of radio broadcasts that Jennifer discovered and became very obsessed with, because they were really beautiful.
Yeah, beautifully crafted. And so we got to talk to, somebody from the team behind that, and there wasn't a radio component to the TV show, and he said that the campaign, this promotional campaign, was so successful that that a radio story was getting written into the script of the series, which I thought was really cool. But it was a total nerd moment, and there were some hidden things. You could dial this transistor radio on the app, and they even had a hidden number station on there. So for those of you who are obsessed with these spy stations, where on shortwave you might just hear a voice reciting a series of numbers, and it could be a code to a spy, telling them some secret message. They had a hidden number station on this dial on the promotion for Man in the High Castle. So I just thought, like, the whole thing was created by people who really had a love for radio and for some of these arcane aspects of radio that we obsess about at Radio Survivor. So it was fun. It was fun to talk to them about it and get more insight into how this happened. So I love that episode.
Yeah, a rare occasion where we celebrated a public relations professional and their work.
I know.
Do you have a favorite movie about radio, like Pump Up the Volume or Frequency or Pirate Radio or War of the Worlds or...
Oh, there's so many. There's, you know, there's a lot of DJs in peril, you know, like Play Misty For Me is like super haunting with, you know, it's every DJ's kind of nightmare that some creepy stalker is calling you. There was a teen show called Radio Free Roscoe that I always enjoyed where... And I like, you know, some of the TV shows where there's a high school station or a college station. And it's also fun to just kind of mock them and talk about everything that's being done incorrectly. You know,
like, I cannot stand it when current TV shows pretend that two people are interviewing each other, but they're clearly reading their lines.
Right.
It's one of the weirdest... There's just such a tell that they're reciting their interview.
Or if the news director doesn't have a Band-Aid on him somewhere. Yeah, that right. Went over your head. You know, the Les Nessman, every episode of WKRP, he had a Band-Aid somewhere.
That's pretty funny. Well, I mean, often people aren't wearing headphones, and that drives
right.
me crazy.
Yes.
They're not close enough to the microphone.
Yeah, they're not talking into a microphone. So that's fun. But, you know... Sadly, you don't see radio much in popular culture
yeah.
today. Oh,
One
I know one of my favorite.
Jennifer, have you seen One Mississippi?
No.
It's a new Amazon show where comedian Tig Notaro is playing a version of herself that's a radio DJ, and she moves to Mississippi but keeps doing her KCRW radio show remotely. And she is a radio professional, but the microphone's like about a foot and a half away from her mouth, so it makes no sense.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to get a great shot. I actually visited a college radio station recently, and their studio had been used on, I think, the show Atlanta. So that was kind of cool to visit somewhere and find out that their station had been used, you know, by a production team. And apparently the production team, like, moved things and kind of messed things up and actually took the station off the air. like, they were explicitly told, do not touch, you know, any of this specific equipment. So that's some of the danger of, you know, letting the production team into your actual station.
My favorite radio movie today is The Fisher King, where a late night... mean-spirited disc jockey inspires a nut to kill people, and then the movies. It's a Terry Gilliam movie. So the movie takes place in
the aftermath.
I
don't remember the radio part. Yeah,
yeah. That, you know, the Jeff.
Daniels.
But the Jeff, not Daniels.
The other Jeff.
The other handsome Jeff, who's always in Terry Gilliam movies.
Exactly, yes.
He uses his power as a radio disc jockey unwisely. He wields this power at the microphone cavalierly, and he gets people hurt by spewing his hate. So it's a, and this, you know, this is, I think, a late 80s, early 90s version of this story. Jeff Bridges,
that's right, yes.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the images of radio DJs in popular culture are talk radio DJs. Where it's a story similar to what you're describing, or it's like in a horror movie format. But it seems like a talk radio DJ is either like a villain or a hero. It's interesting. The music DJ doesn't always get as much star billing.
You can't use all the licensed music in your project.
I don't know if either of you saw Under the Dome. It was a Stephen King series on TV, and they actually had a female radio engineer had a heroic role in Under the Dome, you know, when all sorts of really bad stuff was happening. You know, it's like a horror story.
That ticks a lot of boxes, though.
I know. I was very excited. Like, not only is it an engineer at a radio station, but it's a female engineer, and she was, like, saving the day. So that was an exciting moment.
There used to be a lot more horror movies that had late night DJs in them as part of the horror. People were listening, or the attack was at the radio station or something like that.
Yeah, you just name dropped Twin Peaks an hour and a half ago, and I just watched that episode where the radio station is used by dark forces to propagate some terrible spell.
Interesting.
I don't know. Is it too early to drop spoilers for the return of Twin Peaks?
I have not watched the Twin Peaks reboot, so please don't.
Oh, I like my favorite radio pop culture thing is Northern Exposure. I loved how radio station in Northern Exposure was right in the center of the community, and the way that radio DJ character was, you know, here's somebody who's speaking into a microphone who doesn't sound like they're reading a script, that character. And also just how wonderfully central he was to the community that show was about. Like, there's a really good example of radio on television.
Yeah, Do the Right Thing, similarly, has a radio station in the midst of a lot of different chaos.
Yeah, those are great examples.
All right, well, I've kept you way longer than we were supposed to. Is there anything else you guys want to tell people about? We're talking to Jennifer Waits and Eric Klein from the Radio Survivor website and the Radio Survivor radio show. It's radiosurvivor.org or .com?
We're .com.
And anything else you want to tell our listeners?
Well, we're always interested in hearing people's stories, so you know, people are welcome to send us tips about radio stations that we should write about and stories that we should cover. So there's information on the website on how to reach us.
Yeah, go to radiosurvivor.com. The purpose of the blog, the website, and the podcast, the radio show, is to add to the conversation, to broaden the conversation, and also to shine a light on all of the good ideas that are happening out in the non-commercial radio landscape. I mean, I tend to think that there's that the only reason why what is going on in this big and beautiful broad world of community radio is not more well known is that there's just like so little money in it, right? There is no trade publication for community radio because it's barely a trade. And yet the culture that's happening here on the margins of the media landscape, on community radio stations, on low power radio stations, on college radio stations, and in podcasting now, there's a story every minute that we don't know about. And so that's what Radio Survivor is trying to fill the gap. And of course, what Jennifer just said, if you know one of those stories and you could help us tell it, even just by giving us a tip about who to talk to, please reach out, go to the website, radiosurvivor.com, and get in touch. We'd love to hear from you.
And where does the name come from? I didn't ask that question.
Radio Survivor?
Well,
Matthew made it up.
Yeah, it comes from Matthew. And so I would hate to answer for him. you know, I have had people say to me that it sounds like a negative description of the state of radio, but I don't think any of us interpret it that way.
I mean,
you know, because we're definitely celebratory of radio, and radio, I don't think radio is dead or dying, but I think some people have the false, or you know, you can interpret it however you want, but some people think Radio Survivor implies that radio needs saving or is on the brink of death, but I think we see it in a different way, that radio is, you know, continues, will continue.
I do think when Matthew came up with the idea Radio Survivor, there was a news story every day on the front page of something or other that was heralding the imminent death of radio. I mean, we're in the late aughts, and this was a time where the internet was bringing a demise to all sorts of legacy media type things. And so, of course, radio is next. The internet is going to finally do away with this sad and graying dinosaur that is radio. And Radio Survivor, is, you know, puts forth a counter argument that that things have been done in this medium that are valuable and will continue to be done in the medium that is extremely valuable. And so stay tuned.
Yeah, and with net neutrality, it might be that the internet has less force in people's lives in the future. Who knows?
Yeah, I still think that, you know, the future of AM, what if AM becomes like this really radical new place for, you know, you never know what might happen.
Yeah, we did an episode about that where I learned everything I never knew about AM radio back on Radio Survivor. It's really a dirty sound now because of LED light bulbs and Wi-Fi routers. They've allowed a lot of encroachment into the frequency. And it's true. I've noticed that when you drive around a city listening to AM radio, it's a completely different experience than it was 20 years ago. Every stoplight creates interference.
Yeah, that could be your new transmission radio is just the sounds of AM interference.
Yeah, there's a lot of it, yes. And the FCC or Chairman Pai wants it to put those stations onto FM translators.
Right. We've covered that on Radio Survivor. Gotten that nerdy.
But you think AM could become this re-envisioned space for something in the future?
I have that in my dreams, but, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of different takes on what will happen with AM.
There are market forces at play.
Yeah,
as we've learned on Radio Survivor, there have been movements in the past, in the recent past, as we were talking about in the past couple hours, Tom, that people get together and they change things in the radio landscape. When they struggle together, like, things can change. And so if a large enough group of people decided that AM radio was worth fighting for, things on the AM radio dial could really be different in the next generation. It just takes hard work.
All right, we'll go out on that note. Thank you, Jennifer Waits and Eric Klein from the Radio Survivor, from radiosurvivor.com. You can go there to find out the audio version, the text version, and all kinds of other. You've got a Twitter account and maybe a Facebook page. I don't know.
Yeah,
we do. Well,
I think we should abandon the Facebook page. But yeah, it's there. But
we can be found everywhere. We have Instagram too.
Instagram too. Yeah.
But thank you so much, Tom, for having us on Wavefarm. Jennifer and I were commiserating just before you had us on about how cool we think Wavefarm is. We're so glad to have the opportunity to listen to it streaming over the web from our homes. And it's really neat that Radio Survivor is airing on your radio station. So all the listeners should do what they can to keep Radio Survivor, not keep Radio Survivor, all the listeners should do what they can to keep Wavefarm strong moving forward.
And I heard you, Zach Poff's Pond Station is going to be featured in an upcoming episode.
Oh, yeah. I was poking around on your website last week, and I just found so many exciting radio artists that, lit up light bulbs in my radio producer brain. I wanted to talk to them, so I did record an interview with Zach Poff, and I recorded an interview with I've recorded a number of interviews. I have another one coming up on Monday with different radio artists that I found through your organization, through Wavefarm. So yes, stay tuned to Radio Survivor's podcast to hear more about the cool art coming out of Wavefarm. I really appreciate learning about it.
And also, I may be in very close proximity to Wavefarm this summer, so I'm hoping.
Oh yeah, it would be great if you could come
visit.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and if I visit, that will become the topic.
We'll have you back on then.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, we'll return the favor and cover the visit on Radio Survivor.
Right. So. Oh my gosh, that's worth underlining again. Is that one of the cool things that Radio Survivor does, both in the blog and in the podcast, is share Jennifer's radio station visits. You know, she's a radio station tourist that covers all of these unique spaces, these and the people that inhabit them, all of these radio stations all over the country. You've visited over 100 and ... stations and written them up, right, Jennifer?
Yeah, over 140.
Over 140 unique radio station visits that Jennifer has covered for Radio Survivor. And it's really, like, you know, this was something that we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation today, just that there's so much history and there are so many stories going on out there in radio that it's just, I feel very lucky that every time Jennifer shares something else that she learns by visiting a radio station. So it's apropos that a Wave Farm visit is in the near future.
I know. Well, and it's inspiring to visit other stations, and it's cool when other radio stations share radio news and talk about the broader community of radio. I think that doesn't happen very often either. You know, to have radio stations talking about other radio stations. So, I look forward to the continued circular relationship.
All right. Well, thank you guys both for joining us today, and we'll get this up on the archives at wgxc.org, and you can go to radiosurvivor.com for more information, too.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, everybody.
All right. We'll be talking to you soon, then. Maybe seeing you soon, Jennifer.
Yes. I will keep you posted.